Welcome, everyone, to Undisclosed Season 2, Episode 8. We've got three great sponsors this week, Stamps.com, Blue Apron, and Mack Weldon. Support our sponsors because, of course, they support us. Listen in for the spots later in the show. Until then, enjoy.
After it was discovered that Isaac Dawkins had died from a gunshot wound to the head, fired at him while he was driving, the Rome, Georgia Police Department, led by Detective Jim Mosier, began investigating and eliminating dozens of leads in a methodical way. But then the Floyd County PD stepped in, taking over the case and headed up by a man who would forever change the course of Joey Watkins' life, Stanley Sutton. Hi and welcome to episode 8 of Undisclosed, The State versus Joey Watkins. This episode is Enter Sutton. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney. I'm a fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace. And now I'm the author of the New York Times bestselling book, Adnan's Story. And I'm here as always with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
I'm Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney with the Volkov Law Group, and I blog at viewfromll2.com.
I'm Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
I am a man of constant sorrow. I have seen trouble all my day.
The Coen Brothers movie O Brother, Where Art Thou? Was based upon the Odyssey, the epic poem about Odysseus's decade-long journey to return home after the Trojan War. Odysseus' journey is continually complicated by the obstacles created by Poseidon, the god of the sea, who seeks revenge against Odysseus for blinding his son, despite a decree by Zeus that Odysseus return home safely. In O Brother, the Coen brothers transplant the action from Europe in the 12th or 13th century BC to the American South during the Great Depression, placing the mythology of the original text against the backdrop of a Christian mythos and a southern U.S. folk tradition. And in the film, Sheriff Cooley fills the role of Poseidon, with a similar vendetta against George Clooney's Everett McGill. As the website Hopkins Cinematics describes it, the role of a lawman in the story of a jailbreak has many different cultural implications. Daniel Von Bargen's appearance and performance in the part of Sheriff Cooley were inspired by Boss Godfrey and Cool Hand Luke, but the fear and awe that surround him is an older cultural idea. Here, the Christian and Southern mythology combine to add an additional layer to his character. Early in the film, the trio stumble on Tommy Johnson, named and based on the real man who also legendarily sold his soul at a crossroads in rural Mississippi for his skill on the guitar. When asked what the devil looks like, Everett describes the traditional red and scaly with a bifurcated tail, and he carries a hayfork. And Tommy corrects him, describing Sheriff Cooley perfectly, saying, "He's white as you folks, with empty eyes and a big hollow voice. He loves to travel around with a mean old hound. Every time the sheriff appears, even at night, he's wearing mirror sunglasses, and most of the time, the reflection contains a fire. Thus, he becomes three characters in one: the lawman, Poseidon, and the devil." While Floyd County Sheriff Stanley Sutton certainly fits the archetype of the old-school southern lawman, it would be unfair and hyperbolic to compare him to Poseidon or the devil. But one thing's for certain, he was hell-bent on bringing Joey to justice. Georgia-style justice.
You know that feeling you get when you can get things done with the click of a button? It can't get more convenient than that. And now, you can even get your mailing and shipping done without leaving your desk, thanks to Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can turn your PC or Mac into your own personal post office. One that never closes, and one that's always there when you need it. Talk about convenient, because you can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package, using your computer and printer. Then, hand your mail to the mailman or drop it in a mailbox, and you're good to go. You'll never have to go to the post office again. I use Stamps.com because there is a lot of postage due to go out when you're doing investigations, and a lot of agencies that need to receive requests for information. With Stamps.com, I can do it faster and without having to spend my day at the post office. So right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use our promo code UNDISCLOSED for the special offer. You'll get a 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. Don't wait! Go to Stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the page and type in undisclosed. Stanley Sutton is a polarizing figure. I can't say I've run into too many people who are neutral about Sutton, except maybe for a few who have said, well, I personally haven't had a problem with him, but... Because there are a lot of people out there who have a lot of strong feelings about Stanley Sutton and the way he operated as an officer during his 4 decades in the force. On the one hand, there are a lot of people who feel he's done wrong, either to them or people they've known, or else they've questioned his integrity as an officer. But on the other hand, I've also run into a lot of people who spoke very fondly of Sutton and sung his praises as a police officer. Sure, they say, with the kind of boys will be boys attitude, he had his quirks, but if trouble moved onto your block, he's exactly the kind of officer you'd want in charge of stopping it. Basically, if this was a cop movie, Stanley Sutton would be the loose cannon who refuses to play by the rules, but damn it, does he get the job done. And over the course of this investigation, I've heard a lot of stories about Stanley Sutton. Some of them kind of hilarious, and some of them kind of disturbing. To give you an idea of what kind of stories these are, unfortunately, they're usually coming from people who say that they'll tell me it on the condition I don't repeat it to anyone else, because they don't want to get involved in anything. So unfortunately, I can't share those, but here are a few I can share with you. This first story comes from someone who was with the fire department in Rome. He didn't know Sutton personally, but sometimes ran into him on the job. This one time, he said, there'd been a car wreck, and he was there to assist. When Stanley Sutton drove up to the scene, Sutton had a trainee with him that day, so rather than taking care of the paperwork himself, he let the trainee do the job. Even though technically Sutton should have been there showing the trainee the ropes, he figured the trainee could handle it. And at some point, the firefighter was wondering just where Sutton had gotten to, and looked around and finally found him, when he looked down the grass gully at the edge of the road and saw Sutton walking around down there, bent over at the waist, and periodically grabbing at the grass. The firefighter couldn't figure out what Sutton was doing and went back to processing the wreck scene. But once they gotten everything cleared up, Sutton wandered back over to join them on the roadside. Then, as someone asked him a question about where he'd been the whole time, Sutton opened his mouth as if to answer, and whoosh, grasshoppers came flying out everywhere. That was Sutton's sense of humor. And then there's a story from the tow truck driver we talked about in episode 4, Terry Ferguson. When Claire and I spoke to him, he told us about a story about a run-in he'd had with Sutton in his younger days and Sutton's unorthodox law enforcement techniques. One time, Terry said, Sutton picked him up for an offense. But rather than take him to jail, Sutton decided on a different form of punishment instead.
He caught me one time. We're stealing copper. Instead of taking me to jail, he made me ride around with him all day.
In his police car?
Yeah. And the neighborhood that I was growed up in was just on the back side over there where the wreck happened. It was a rough neighborhood, and he didn't want to be seen with the police back then.
Were you in the back?
No, I was in the front.
He put you in the front?
And rode me around off in my neighborhood and all over Rome that day and turned me loose.
Did he know what he was doing? What was...
Yeah, he was getting it where nobody would talk to me or go around me. None of my friends. And
what did he tell you on this ride?
I think I helped him catch somebody breaking in a house. I run him down. Because right after he picked me up, he responded to a burglary call. And I still remember the guy's name was Godfrey. And we caught him over behind the trailer park on Darlington Drive. And Stanley told me to jump out and catch him. And after that, then Stanley took me home. But all my friends just saw me in the car with him, and they wouldn't have nothing to do with me for a long time.
Did you realize that at the time, what he was doing?
Or? Oh, yeah.
Okay. You couldn't do anything about it.
But it was better than going to jail.
So Sutton made it seem like Terry had been a snitch in order to isolate him from all of his friends. And along the way, he used Terry's help to nab a fleeing fugitive. Joey has his own Stanley Sutton story, too. Well, even before he became Stanley Sutton's personal obsession for a year.
I can't remember what grade I was in, maybe third grade, fourth grade. And the girl that lived beside us and one of her friends made a bomb threat to our Murchie High School. And I walked to the store with them that morning. They didn't want to go to school. That's why they did it. And I knew that they made the call. Well, that afternoon, I told a buddy of mine named Eric Harris about the bomb threat. I was trying to be cool and sound, you know, and I told him about it. So he told everyone. He went and told the principals. He went and told everybody. So I get pulled out by the principal at the time. And then Stanley Sutton and another investigator came and talked to me. He threatened me, threatened to lock my family up. And he asked me, he said, I can remember him looking at me and asking me, he said, "You love your mom and dad?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And he was like, "Well, I'm going to lock them up if you don't tell me everything that happened." And he kind of ran the whole trying to scare me, get him up. But yeah, that's my first experience with him.
And I was asking you if you thought he'd actually remember you. I mean, 10, 15 years later, or I guess 10 years later, probably, if you were like 9.
Yeah, he remembers me. But the reason being is, you know, I was telling you about Ashley and her and Brianne being friends, going to her house, and I'd actually got mad at Brianne, and I was messing with Ashley for a little bit, trying to get with her just to make Brianne jealous. And he asked me a couple times why I was there. "You staying out of trouble?" And, you know, stuff like that.
And yeah, I know. Trying to make Brianne jealous by going out with Sutton's stepdaughter was definitely not one of Joey's brightest moves.
That guy, I mean, he followed me I don't know how many times.
I mean, it
got around town, like at work, on the weekends. Ask Kelly, she can tell you. He followed me and Kelly all the way to Kennesaw one time.
Could you see it was him?
And I mean, yeah, you could see it was him. He drove a gray Crown Vic. I mean, it was so obvious, you know? I mean, it was just, I mean, I guess he was trying to intimidate me or make me run or something like that. I can remember me and Kelly going to Sonic one time. I guess he was trying to act like he was undercover or something. I don't know what the guy's intentions were, but we were sitting at Sonic in West Rome. There used to be like a little workout gym down there. And he pulled down there and he pulled up through the parking lot so I could see. I guess he was trying to make himself known to me. And then he pulled down there and backed into a parking spot in front of the little gym. The whole time we were sitting there at Sonic eating. And he was kind of like staring me down, you know, like, I'm like, "Really? I'm trying to eat? Can you leave me alone, please?" But I figured after the guy, you know, he seen, you know, my daily routine. And, you know, I mean, if you watch somebody intently like that, you're going to eventually get an idea of who they are. And I'm like, maybe he'll just go on and leave me alone, you know. But evidently that wasn't the case.
So we're going to talk a little bit now about Stanley Sutton's work history. In September of 1972, he was hired by the Floyd County Police Department as a patrol officer. On March 2nd, 1973, he was certified by the Police Officer Standards and Training Council as a peace officer and graduated from the police academy. A few years later, on January 11th, 1976, he was promoted to sergeant. On April 11th, 1978, he became a sergeant investigator. 4 years later, in 1982, he graduated from the FBI National Academy in Quantico. His resume then says that from 1985 to 1997, he was a sergeant assigned to the Rome Floyd Metro Drug Task Force. More on that later, though. In 1987, he became a senior sergeant. And at the time of his retirement in 2005, 33 years after he started working for Floyd County, he was a police intelligence officer. But Sutton's career was definitely a mixed bag. And we know that because during this investigation, GIP, the Georgia Innocence Project, actually pulled the personnel files for both Sutton and Moser.
One of the reports in Sutton's file that seems a little bit emblematic of his career on the force and his interactions with other agencies comes from 1982, when a superior wrote, "Dear Sergeant Sutton, on or about March 29th, 1982, four inmates escaped from the Floyd County Jail. The custody of these prisoners is the responsibility of the Floyd County Sheriff's Department. I was informed Friday evening, April 2nd, by Tommy Shiflett, and Sheriff Bill Hart that you had conducted an interview with an inmate who was in the custody of the Sheriff's Department. It is my understanding that this interview was conducted at the request of Sergeant Doug Kilgo. If your intentions were to aid a fellow law enforcement officer in the performance of his duties, you are to be commended for your assistance. However, if you were aware that the sheriff was conducting an internal investigation into the escape and you injected yourself into the investigation without prior approval from this department, you were in serious error and in violation of department policy. Officers from this department must not allow personal motives to govern their decisions. Our department policy requires that we maintain a close working relationship with other law enforcement agencies, and for some time, our relationship with the Sheriff's Department, to say the least, has been strained. I am not blaming you for the condition of the relationship, but your actions certainly didn't help. The most disturbing thing about your actions is that you failed to even inform your immediate supervisor about the request from Sergeant Kilgo. It is your responsibility to stay familiar with department policy and to govern your actions accordingly. Now, as with just about everything in Sutton's personnel file, it's written in innuendo and vague allusions to bigger problems going on. Here, all we know is that Sutton interviewed someone in conjunction with the escape from the jail, but for some reason this warranted a reprimand and a comment from a supervisor, officers from this department must not allow personal motives to govern their decisions. Now, what personal motives those may have been, or why they would have caused Sutton to interview this person, is never explained.
Well, I mean, it's an example of what you said before about him going off book instead of being by the book. He's not informing his supervisor. He's conducting this interrogation off book. And yeah, as you say, it's sort of wishy-washy language. It's equivocal, but it seems quite clear that he has done something in this case that's based upon his own personal feelings. And by doing so, he has caused tension in the relationship among these different law enforcement agencies.
He sounds very much like the archetypical kind of, in my head, like the Southern law enforcement officer who just, you know, he's the law. When he, you know, he does what he wants to do as he wants to do it, as long as he gets the results that he wants.
But the results he wants here, at least, I think the implication is they're not about law enforcement strictly. It's some personal agenda. Anyway, looking at Sutton's annual evaluations, you kind of get a sense that the grasshopper story I told earlier wasn't a one-off thing. In a 1988 report, his supervisor wrote, for employee strengths, Stanley is a very effective investigator. He is a very good witness in court. As for areas where he needed improvement, the supervisor wrote, sometimes he carries on too much BS at inappropriate times. At the bottom of the sheet, Sutton was able to respond to these evaluations, and he wrote, that is my personality, having fun. So therefore, I will continue with BS, as Chief Jim Free calls it.
He's definitely not taking the feedback seriously on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's someone who seems to have a large personality and think that they're larger than the law. And yeah, it seems they're complimenting him that he gets good results, but at the same time, he's playing by his own rules, and he quite blatantly is responding, that's just me, it's my personality, it's what I'm going to do.
So there aren't any other serious reprimands that are in the personnel files that were maintained by Floyd County, but there are little hints of scandal here and there, like in the letters of commendation he's received over the decades. For example, in 1997, after his demotion as the commander of the Rome Floyd Metro Drug Task Force, here's what one citizen wrote. Sergeant Sutton's tenure as commander was the finest highlight of what one man could do to alleviate the drug problem here in Rome. The drug dealers feared and respected him because they knew that once their name came across his desk, he would not stop until they were behind bars where they belonged. As a private citizen, I can tell you I do not believe that replacing Sergeant Sutton will slow the drug trade in the city. The rumors that permeated the community concerning his rotation were spawned more likely by some individuals that were looking for revenge and to besmirch his reputation. But the people who know Stanley Sutton know that the job that he did to remove the drug elements from the streets has gained him more respect than any rumor could ever take away. So that makes you wonder, what was a rumor or rumors? Then you have another letter from a prosecutor that was written earlier in his career in 1984. Stanley, we have had our differences in the past. However, I admire your ability to get along with a stubborn prosecutor like me, who insisted on pushing the court as much as necessary to prevent Ellis from getting out on bond. I felt and I continue to feel that it was essential to keep him in jail in order to prevent any further cases. You will recall that we were accused of misusing our authority. I'm aware of nothing that has been done in this case that would not have been done in a similar gang rape under similar circumstances in another jurisdiction or by any other prosecutor. The accusations made against you by the defendant's families, etc., are unfounded as acknowledged by certain people in the courtroom during last Wednesday's hearing. It appears to me that you were doing nothing more than your usual good job in this case.
Yeah, I mean, that said, while we have these things where there's at least nibblings of misconduct or bad behavior, there are plenty of favorable comments about his performance. For instance, we can see in his files that on more than one occasion while off-duty, Sutton responded to accidents that he happened to be close by to when they occurred and saved the lives of victims, including one time during a hunting accident and another time when the sides of a hole collapsed on some road workers. Also, his superiors frequently referred to Sutton as one of Floyd's best investigators, and as was noted in one of the personnel comments before, he apparently was an excellent and thorough witness in court. So good, in fact, that when he testified before a grand jury, one of the grand jurors wrote to him after the hearing in April 2001. Dear Officer Sutton, I'm currently serving on the Floyd County Grand Jury and heard your presentation of the Dawkins case. I'm impressed with the thoroughness with which you gave your presentation. In discussion with one of the other ladies also serving, the other members were equally impressed. It is very obvious that you take your position seriously and the drive to delve into every channel that might give you more insight and information. I don't believe that this case is an exception. I believe that you enter each one with the same energy. I did not feel comfortable my first time to serve to ask any further questions. However, you covered so completely every phase. Let me congratulate you on your ability to present with such clarity. I would like to meet with you face to face and congratulate you in person. Now, on the other hand, when I did a Westlaw search, I found four cases that involved Sutton. One was just generally noting his involvement in the case, but the other three actually all involved some misconduct by Sutton. So let's quickly do a rundown of those cases. The first of these cases was Hendricks versus State. And in Hendricks versus State, Hendricks was accused of two counts of violating the Controlled Substances Act. And Sutton arrived at Hendricks' workplace and was told that Hendricks was deaf. Sutton's response was that, quote, he'd taken 3 months of sign language at Floyd College many years ago and can do a little bit of signing. As a result, he felt comfortable questioning Hendricks. He then indicated that he used sign language to communicate to Hendricks that his son had marijuana at school and had told a school official that he got it from Hendricks. Now, according to Sutton, Hendricks responded that he wanted to see the pot, which prompted Sutton to take him to the police station. Upon arrival at the station, Sutton got a consent form and basically talked to Hendricks to get him to read the consent form, asked him if he would give permission to go to his home to get the pot, and according to Sutton, Hendricks signed the form after Sutton explained, quote, if he didn't give us permission or if he didn't sign this, that we would have to talk to a judge and try to get a search warrant. There were two ways we could go about this, you know. So Hendricks signed the consent form, they proceeded to Hendricks' house, and Sutton found the marijuana. During this whole course of the investigation, Sutton never read Hendricks the Miranda warnings, and he never got a qualified interpreter as was required by Georgia law. So, of course, Hendricks filed a motion to suppress the evidence in the case. It was before Judge Matthews of the Floyd Superior Court, and the motion was granted, and that was affirmed on appeal. On the interpreter question, the court ruled that in this case, Sutton was not certified as a sign language interpreter. He had not kept up with the development of sign language and the changes in signs. He had not had any other courses in it since 1972 or 73, so decades earlier. Sergeant Sutton also confirmed he had made no attempts to call or locate a certified interpreter for the deaf at any time. On the Miranda issue, Sutton's claim was, well, I didn't have Hendricks in custody, and the court flatly rejected that argument, saying, your actions clearly would have led a reasonable man in Hendricks' shoes to feel he was not free to leave. He was in custody. You had to read him the Miranda warning. So, you know, Robbie and Susan, this is a case, again, of Sutton kind of thinking he's above the law, thinking, I'm not really trained in sign language, but I can substitute for an interpreter. I don't have to get the Miranda warnings, and, you know, it comes back to bite him, where the Court of Appeals says you can't use the evidence you recovered from his house.
This is kind of amazing to me because I'll be honest, I actually took a whole year of sign language in college. And at this point, I couldn't even probably ask somebody what their name is because if you're not using it, there's no way you. I mean, so I think this was, you know, I would love to see how Stanley Sutton actually tried to use a sign language, but I think it was probably him just taking advantage of the situation.
Then we have the case of Wilson versus State, and this was in August 1989, and the Georgia Bureau of Investigation began conducting undercover drug operations in and around Rome, Georgia. This is sort of consistent with what we discussed before with the drug issue that was occurring there. and there was a confidential informant who introduced GBI agents to suspected drug dealers. Those agents would then attempt to make purchases of drugs from persons implicated by the informant, and if the agents, in fact, made this controlled buy from a particular suspect, the arrest was postponed to avoid compromising the success of the continuing operations in the area. So on August 17, 1989, the informant and agents Scott Whitley, Kathy Sapp, and Cheryl Bowers traveled to a residence in Rome. They purchased drugs, and Agent Whitley ultimately purchased the cocaine at issue from a person identified by the informant as Alfred Turner, also known as Big Al. Now, the following April, so several months later, the GBI concluded the operations, and they went to conduct the arrest of Al Turner. And when they couldn't find Al Turner, all of a sudden, Sutton, who was involved, had whatever you might describe it as, a light bulb, something else. And he said, well, actually, thinking about it, Agent Whitley's description of Al Turner matched the description of another man named Alfred Lee Wilson. And so Sutton took Agent Whitley to Wilson's place of employment. Agent Whitley identified him as the person who sold him drugs. There was an arrest, and we had the trial. And, you know, in essence, the claim by the defendant was, well, it wasn't me. It was this other individual, Al Turner. That was the person identified by the informant. And you need to tell me who the informant is because I need to figure out whether, in fact, he was claiming that I sold the drugs or Al Turner, which was the name that he used. And both men were African-American. The photos used to show the witnesses in the case who the person could be were low quality. And eventually the court finds, yeah, I mean, absolutely, you have to turn over this confidential informant. And this, quoting from the language of the Court of Appeals of Georgia, in this case, we find the state failed to establish at trial that the name actually communicated to police by the confidential informer of an actual person residing in the vicinity could not have been the name of the person who committed the crime. So again, this is sort of a case where it's tough to say exactly what happened, but it certainly seems like it's possibly a personal vendetta, but it's Sutton taking the name given to him by the informant and saying, well, it's not him, but there's someone else who looks like that person. Let's arrest him, and possibly disastrous consequences. The third and final case that I'll discuss is the Ellis case. It was the one referenced previously in the personnel file, and it sort of combines what we've been discussing of Sutton both acting outside the law a bit and serving as a good witness. And so Ellis versus State was a 1987 case in which Tommy Ellis was charged with rape and related crimes. Sutton had an arrest warrant for Ellis, found out that he'd been taken into custody in Cedar Bluff, Alabama. And at trial, he testified he went down to Alabama, he identified Ellis and told him who he was. And of course, Ellis knew who he was. Then the prosecutor asked a very simple question. Who was he? And Sutton replied, Tommy Ellis, which was the only response he should have given. But then he added on, and at that point, I advised him of his Miranda warnings of the United States, which I had a waiver of counsel. We have a form that I let him read his Miranda rights, and I read them also, and he refused to sign it and wanted his attorney. Defense counsel, of course, in the case immediately moved for a mistrial because the second half of the answer was both non-responsive and constituted an adverse comment on Ellis's invocation of his constitutional rights. The trial court denied that motion for a mistrial, but it immediately gave a curative instruction that the jury was to ignore Sutton's response. Ellis later appealed the decision not to grant a mistrial, and the Court of Appeals disagreed. They found, though, that Sutton acted completely inappropriately. They found, however, that the immediate instruction by the trial court to the jury to draw no inference from the unresponsive answer by Sutton was sufficient to correct any possible harm. So, again, Sutton extremely effective as a witness, but it's by going outside the bounds of the law, commenting on his invocation of his Miranda rights. And then beyond that, we have the personnel file, which was not part of the case, where apparently the defendant's families took objection to whatever it was Sutton did in the case, where, again, it's elliptical, we're not quite sure what happened, but beyond what he testified to, seemingly there were issues in the case.
We're going to check in now with one of our great sponsors this week, Blue Apron. Now, some of you may be following along on Twitter as I battle it out with Dennis Robinson, our executive producer, over our Blue Apron meals. But I'm happy to say that my husband has been taking up the challenge on my behalf lately. I've been traveling a lot because of my book launch, and thanks to Blue Apron, I haven't had to worry about my family getting a fresh, hot meal made with premium ingredients. Clean, ethically sourced, high-quality ingredients that are measured in the exact proportions you need, that come with these beautiful recipe cards, color photographs that are easy to follow, and they're supplied from a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, ranches, and fisheries. That's what you get with Blue Apron, all for under $10 a person, per meal, delivered right to your door. And right now, as I'm recording this, my husband is making a lunch that I can smell two floors away. Curried catfish with fragrant coconut rice and crisp green beans. And yes, I will post pictures on Twitter, and I can't wait. You shouldn't either, and you don't have to, because Blue Apron is offering our listeners a great deal. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free, absolutely free, with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/undisclosed. You're going to love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/undisclosed. And then, don't forget to tweet us your pictures. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Until very recently, just the week of August 22nd, we thought that this was the entirety of the information that we knew about Stanley Sutton's career. But then we came across a couple of stories about an incident that occurred in 1989. Here's a story from the Rome News Tribune dated March 20th, 1989. A veil of secrecy surrounds the suspension of Sheriff's Captain Stanley Sutton, and Floyd County commissioners say they're not even sure they can lift it. Sheriff Mike Thornton said this past Friday that he had suspended Sutton, the department's warrants commander, for 15 days without pay, retroactive to March 5th. He had placed Sutton on administrative leave with pay on March 2nd after an inmate at the Floyd County Jail filed a written complaint charging that Sutton had violated department policy and had committed an unspecified misdemeanor offense. Thornton has not said when the incident occurred or when the complaint was filed. Sutton, formerly a sergeant with the Floyd County Police Department, joined the Sheriff's Department on January 1st when Thornton became sheriff. Thornton said an investigation of the incident by Sheriff's Department and Rome Police Department personnel confirmed Sutton had violated a department policy listed in a general order of policies and procedures. But he said it failed to prove or disprove Sutton also committed a misdemeanor offense. Thornton also placed Sutton on 6 months probation because of the violation. Sutton was to have returned to work on Monday. So this is kind of odd because Sutton's own resume doesn't mention at all that he ever worked as a sheriff's captain. And while we do have Sutton's personnel records, there was no reference of this incident in them. So Colin asked Claire about this, and she noted these irregularities as well. But she also said that she didn't open records request with the Floyd County's Sheriff's Department for anything related to the incident, but she was told that all of those files had been destroyed pursuant to retention policies. Having said that, one document related to the incident still existed. A July 1989 document titled Probable Cause Committee Recommendation to Council. And this is where things get interesting.
After everything I'd read about Sutton, I'd considered calling him the Deep South Dirty Harry because of his unconventional way of seeking justice. I refrained, though, because I thought the label might be unfair, but this report reads like something right out of Magnum Force or Sudden Impact. The report contains the following allegation. On March 2, 1989, the law enforcement unit received a complaint from an inmate that said officer, Stanley Sutton, had pointed a weapon at the inmate while inside the lockup area of the jail. Sutton, of course, refuted the allegation, kind of. According to the report, said officer claims he came through a door and began, quote, clowning around, quote, jiving, or engaging in, quote, horseplay with the inmate. When said officer removed the weapon from said officer's pocket and allegedly pointed it at the inmate, said officer admitted exhibiting the weapon but denied pointing it at the inmate.
And I will say, this section here kind of reminded me of an interview I had with one witness who didn't want to be named, but talked about a time that they'd had horseplay, quote unquote, with Stanley Sutton that resulted in the witness having a few bones broken. The committee actually sided with the inmate. Here are the findings of the internal investigation. On March 1st, 1989, said officer, that is Sutton, did carry a loaded weapon to the lockup area of the jail. Said officer exhibited the firearm to the inmate in a threatening and or intimidating manner. The weapon was an unauthorized weapon, as dictated by departmental policies. That report goes on to note that the loaded weapon was a nickel-plated revolver, and the investigation revealed the inmate was an informant whom Sutton had used over the years. Apparently, however, this time, the informant hadn't been providing Sutton with the information he wanted, so Sutton decided to interrogate him by other means. And it seemingly wasn't the first time this had happened. Quote, the investigation revealed that a similar incident possibly happened on two other occasions, one inside the jail and one outside while said officer was a detective.
So this is obviously deeply troubling for a number of reasons. First, it's completely unacceptable for a police officer to try and extract information from someone at gunpoint, both because of the threat of violence and the likelihood that the coerced information is not going to be true. Second, the report makes it clear that this very likely was not an isolated incident. And the fact that Sutton improperly removed his tenure at the sheriff's office from his resume means that defendants in any number of cases handled by Sutton had no idea where to find a record of this report. Now, in our first season case, we discussed how multiple murder convictions were thrown out in Baltimore because the state failed to disclose personnel records that showed that Detective Daryl Massey was engaged in a scheme to fraudulently receive overtime. The non-disclosure of this incident or these incidents with Sutton seems several orders of magnitude worse and much more important.
Of course, it wouldn't have been Brady in this case, because Stanley Sutton never testified at Joey's trial. No, I don't know why. Yes, that's weird. Super weird. Stanley Sutton was the lead investigator of the case, the one who made Joey's arrest and conviction happen. So why didn't he testify? Tammy Coulson tried to argue in her closing arguments that it was because the trial had already gone on long enough, so why waste even more of the jury's time when the 4th of July was coming up? But Sutton's testimony wouldn't have been merely a repeat of everything else that had already been said at trial. Sutton more or less was the case. So why didn't they call him? And Joey has wondered, too, why his attorneys didn't call Sutton if Tammy Coulson didn't do it. So Sutton was in the courtroom.
He was in the courtroom. He sat at the table with her the whole time.
He sat at the main bench?
Prosecution, yes. He sat at the prosecution table.
And then they didn't call him to the stand?
Nope. I don't understand. That's just... I can't fathom that. What, you have a lead detective in a murder case and you don't put him on a stand. Couldn't my defense call him to the stand? Was there any way possible they could?
No, they absolutely could have called him to the stand.
Okay, this is what I don't understand. When I asked Rex Abernathy, please put him on the stand. Get him on the stand. Get him on a stand. He's like, I can't do that now. I can't do that.
Oh, he could. He absolutely could.
And he's like, I'm like, why are you not calling him to the stand? The guy's already taken the Fifth Amendment. Call him on the stand. Put him on the stand. And Bill Odell was mad. Bill and Rex argued about that.
Here's Claire and I driving back to Atlanta in the rain after a long day of wrangling up witnesses in Rome, or at least attempting to. We just tracked down the phone number for who in 2000 was Rome Police Department Captain Marshall Smith. Or rather, we tracked down his daughter who called him for us. And while he wouldn't give his phone number to Claire, he did agree to speak to her briefly on his daughter's phone. He told Claire that he didn't remember much of anything about the case and that he'd only been on the crime scene after Isaac Dawkins' truck was loaded onto the wrecker. And that was kind of the extent of his involvement. But Marshall Smith did remember what happened after Floyd County took over the case.
But he also, it was interesting, his take on that was also, you know, Stanley Sutton's the one who found the evidence in the case. He's the one who did the arrest.
Hmm.
So.
Just now he said that?
Yeah. Georgia 101
South. So he remembers something.
He does.
Sutton found the evidence. It's an interesting way of putting it.
I thought so, too.
And the only evidence he found were those snitches.
With completely inconsistent stories.
Now,
Now, Stanley Sutton had a knack for finding people in jail that had heard confessions from other inmates, and his strategy was actually pretty ingenious. Put up reward posters in the jail block of whoever it is you want to be your suspect, offering money for anyone who gives information leading to a conviction in the case. So, after Sutton was brought on to the Isaac Dawkins case on February 28th, 2000, that same day at 4 o'clock p.m., he put up reward flyers in the Floyd County Jail. And just a few hours later, he got his first hit. A deputy at the jail called and said a man named Barry Mullinax was there, and he had some information that Rome Police Department Detective Jim Moser and Sutton might want to hear. According to Mullinax, he was an eyewitness to the shooting, and he in fact had seen who pulled the trigger.
I know up until now, we've only mentioned one eyewitness to the shooting, Wayne Benson. But some of you may have been doing some digging on your own and found the Supreme Court of Georgia's opinion in Joey's first appeal back in 2003. If so, there are probably a lot of things you're confused about right now, things the Supreme Court talks about in denying his appeal that we actually have never mentioned until now. Things that seem pretty damning of Joey. Things like the following from the Supreme Court's recital of the facts. Shortly after 7 p.m. on January 11, 2000, Dawkins was driving his truck north on Highway 27 after leaving his class at Floyd College. An occupant in a blue or green passenger car fired a shot through the truck's back window and hit Dawkins in the head. One eyewitness identified Watkins as the shooter. That sounds like kind of a big deal. An eyewitness that identified Joey as a shooter? Case closed, right? Well, at trial, a man named Barry Mullinax did testify that he had been on Highway 27 that night, and that he had seen Joey Watkins in a little green Pontiac Sunfire, and that he'd watched as Joey shot out the driver's side window at Isaac's truck just before the truck veered off the road. And although Mullinax came forward after Sutton was on the case, for some reason, maybe just because of who was on duty on the time, it's actually Moser with the Rome Police Department that first speaks to him on the evening of February 28th. Moser's notes from his first conversation with Barry Mullinax are kind of sparse. There's nothing written about what Mullinax actually said, but based on what Moser did next, we've got a good guess. Mullinax told him he was behind Isaac and Joey's vehicle when the murder occurred. That's what Mullinax would say the next day, anyway, and immediately after this first call with Mullinax, Moser picked up the phone himself and made a call to Wayne Benson. This time, Moser had a very important question for him. Other than the mysterious blue Honda, was there anyone else between you and Isaac's truck when it went off the road? And Benson told him no, there was no one. So Moser goes to interview Mullinax the next day, and he gets a recorded statement from him. We don't have the audio for that, because Moser's tape-recorded interviews have never shown up despite all of Claire's searching. But here's Claire's take on Mullinax from Susan's first trip to Rome back in December.
There's not a word that comes out of that man's mouth that's the truth that I can figure out. And in his interview with Detective Moser, you know, he goes through this whole just insane story of heading north on Highway 27 after searching for jobs at two specific job places. I think it was Henderson Mills and one other place, I can't remember.
It really is an insane story. And while we'd love to let you hear Mullinax testify in his own words, the Floyd County Judiciary is too terrified to let it be heard what actually happened in their courtrooms, so we can't share the audio with you. But here's a summary of what Mullinax said. According to Mullinax, back in December of 99, he'd been working at a Crystal down in Cedartown, but he quit or was fired when he tried to get a few days off because his best friend had died. Then on January 11th, he drove back to the Crystal in his red and gray Ford Ranger and asked for his job back. He went to Han Manufacturing to put in a job application before driving north on Highway 27 at around 6:30 p.m. While driving towards the top of a hill, he saw a white pickup truck being chased by a small green car, probably a Pontiac Sunbird, that's a direct quote, by the way, and possibly a Nissan Altima. Now, remember, Joey's sister, Tandy, drove a Pontiac Sunfire. Mullinax also says that the white truck came past him, then the small greenish car. I mean, Mullinax's first statement was taped. We don't have the audio. But what he says there is in many ways, well, I'm sure you're not surprised to hear this, but very different from what he actually says at trial. One thing he does mention in his first statement, though, is that this woman, who he's sure at the time is a woman, is with Joey in the little green car and that one of them fired at Isaac's truck, but he says, I don't know who the woman is, but I seen Joey Watkins in that truck, and I don't know if he shot or the woman shot.
Next, let's turn to the cross-examination of Mullinax by defense attorney Bill O'Dell. During cross-examination, Mullinax claims that he was right behind the little green car, only two or three car lengths behind it. O'Dell then confronts Mullinax with his initial statement to Detective Moser. In that statement, Mullinax had said that the long-haired blonde person in the car with Joey was definitely a woman. And in fact, O'Dell reads Mullinax the transcript of his statement, in which, again, he clearly says, quote, there was a blonde-haired girl in the car, but Mullinax at trial makes the claim that he never said that, and that what he told Moser was it could have been a man or a woman.
But in his statement, he was pretty clear. It was a woman, a blonde-headed woman. And he says that Joey turned right around near the Lighthouse Church, turned back around, went back up to the left, and I don't know who the woman is, but I seen Joey Watkins in that truck. I don't know if he shot or the woman shot. So, again, I don't know if Mullinax is just confused or misspeaking, but he now thinks that Joey's in a truck, not a sunbird. And he knows there's a woman and a man, well, a woman and Joey in the truck or car, but he doesn't know if the woman shot or if Joey shot.
And then there's the matter of the third person in that vehicle, because O'Dell follows up by asking Mullinax whether he told Moser that there were three people, not two people, in the little green car. And Mullinax is adamant at trial that he saw three people, actually, and not two people. O'Dell then goes back and reads him the transcript of his interview with Moser, in which Mullinax was asked by Moser whether there was anyone else in the little green car other than Joey and the long-haired blonde woman, and Mullinex's response in his statement was, quote, that's it. On the witness stand, though, at trial, Mullinax is adamant. He says in the stand, I said there was three people, saying that he told Moser there were three people in the vehicle, despite his recorded statement clearly indicating he only said there were two people. In addition to these inconsistencies about the number of people in the vehicle that allegedly had done the shooting, there's the question of who exactly was in Mullinex's vehicle. At trial, Mullinex claims that his girlfriend Tina Prue and no one else was in the Ford Ranger that he was driving, and in fact, it was Tina Prue's Ford Ranger. Now, he also notes that several people have tried to talk to Prue, but that she refuses to talk to them. In addition to that, there's this, which pretty well sums up the cross-examination of Mullinex. O'Dell reads a statement from Mullinex's initial interview with Moser in which he said, quote, well, hell, I had my girlfriend and her three kids in the damn car. Mullinex responds by quibbling over whether Prue was his girlfriend before O'Dell steers the conversation back to the three kids, prompting the following exchange. Question. Now, are you saying today the three kids were in there, but a while ago you said it was just her? Answer, I remember saying, I don't remember saying. Question, oh. Answer, the three kids was not in the car with us. Question, oh, they weren't. Well, hell, I had my girlfriend and her three kids in the damn car. Answer, I don't remember saying nothing about no three kids. Question, okay, you forgot your own lie when you were telling him the story, didn't you? Answer, I wasn't lying. Question, first you told him you didn't have anybody in the car, and then you slipped up and told him you had somebody in the car, then he starts asking you, well, how is she? Answer, well, let me ask you this. Question, no, I'll ask the questions.
So it seems like what he's saying, that this woman, Prue, was in his car, but then were her three kids there or not? And then there's this. O'Dell reads Mullinax a different portion of his initial statement, in which Mullinax said that there were two people behind him on January 11th. Jamie Wyatt and someone named Kevin. And when I say behind, I mean in cars behind him. So this prompts another fairly typical exchange in this cross-examination. Question. So now you're saying there was someone behind you. Answer. I didn't say she was behind me. I said, see, you're trying to get me confused. Question. I'm just reading what you said. Well, of course, you're saying that you didn't say these things, but I had two people that was behind me. And that was Jamie Weldon? Where was he or she? Answer. I didn't say they was directly behind me. I remember saying that now, sir. I said they was, had followed me when I left the service station, and they were behind me, but they weren't. I didn't say they was directly behind me and seen what happened. I do remember saying now, sir, but her name ain't Jamie Wyatt. Her name is Jamie Weldon, and she used to be an employee at the Waffle House. We could go on, but you get the point.
Now, Moser did investigate what Mullinax was saying. In fact, even before having the taped interview with Mullinax, he was investigating by calling Benson, who immediately said, no, there's no way there could be a truck with Barry Mullinax that was in front of me watching this like he says now. But Mosher also did other things. For instance, he went to the two places that, according to Mullinax, he was at applying for jobs that day. One of them said that they had nothing on record for any Barry Mullinax applying for a job there ever. But the other one said, yeah, we do have an application here from Barry Mullinax looking for a job, but it's dated January 24th. Now, that was never told to the defense, but it's clear that his story about applying for that job on the 11th is bogus. And Mosher also went and talked to the various people that Mullinax mentions who could corroborate his story. And of course, none of them actually corroborated it. Everything about this story is almost too crazy to take seriously, but Claire and I did a little experiment of our own on our drive up to Rome back in December.
What he says that he did was flash his lights or turn his brights on, and then in the reflection of the rearview mirror of the cars in front of him that are going 20 miles an hour faster than he is, he could see the occupants of both separate cars, and he could see that, you know, it was Joey driving, and he had a girl in the passenger seat with long blonde hair. And
so we're driving in the dark right now. Like, there's not a chance in the world we're going to see, like,
let's
just light the brights on.
So.
Yep.
Completely black.
I can see the plate now, license plate.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm sure they're like,
what the heck?
Yeah, you can actually see more of the occupant.
But you can see less inside of the car because the reflection.
Right, you can see more of the shape of the occupant without the brights on than with the brights on. But you certainly can't see any defining characteristics.
So, despite all this, Barry Mullinax was a witness at Joey's trial. But Mullinax's story was so obviously flawed that even Tammy Colston was unable to call him to the stand with a straight face.
If you read the transcript, right before he testifies, Tammy Colston says, we're calling our next witness, for what it's worth, Barry Mullinax. And, you know, she's like, he's a liar, he's this, you know, he's not credible, I get it.
Then why'd you put him on?
But I'm going to put him up, and I'm going to tell you, how could he have known this fact otherwise? Therefore, he was there.
She knew he was lying.
She knew all these people. Well, I don't know that, but
She knew this one was lying.
You know, she would have.
You don't introduce the witness with, for what it's worth.
For whatever it's worth, I call Barry Mullinax to the stand. That's the sort of vouching Tammy Colston is willing to do with the people she puts in front of a jury.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's clear that, you know, Colston knew that Mullinax was going to be lying on the stand, and the only reason to call him was to confuse the jury. So what she does is she tells the jury she's not responsible for the truth of what Mullinax had to say, which to me is kind of like, just, I'm flabbergasted the prosecutor would even say that, but that she was just presenting them all the evidence. But of course, that doesn't immunize her from knowingly presenting false testimony to a jury. I mean, I don't even understand. I've never seen a case in which a prosecutor herself or himself, you know, offers to the jury that, hey, I'm not responsible for whether or not this witness is telling the truth. I mean, you just assume that a prosecutor only puts on witnesses that they believe are telling the truth.
I have a hard time giving Tammy Colston the benefit of the doubt and thinking that she did know Mullinax was lying, because she's not an idiot. She knew Mullinax was lying. Everyone knew Mullinax was lying. Well, everyone investigating the case did. I just don't find it plausible that she did not know Mullinax was lying at the time. And if she didn't, well, maybe there's bigger problems going on.
Yes, let's turn to the law on this. A prosecutor, like any attorney, has a duty not to suborn perjury. Now, perjury is willfully telling a lie in court after having taken the oath, and suborn means to get from a witness. So in other words, an attorney can't knowingly get knowingly false testimony from a witness. Under Georgia Rule of Professional Conduct 3.3A4, a lawyer shall not knowingly offer evidence that the lawyer knows to be false. And according to Comment 8, which accompanies that rule, the prohibition against offering false evidence only applies if the lawyer knows that the evidence is false. A lawyer's reasonable belief that evidence is false does not preclude its presentation to the trier of fact. A lawyer's knowledge that evidence is false, however, can be inferred from the circumstances. Thus, although a lawyer should resolve doubts about the veracity of testimony or other evidence in favor of the client, the lawyer cannot ignore an obvious falsehood. Now, Rule 3.3 is a rule that deals with attorney discipline, and it has a maximum punishment of disbarment. Meanwhile, Kitchens versus State is the key Georgia case on when subornation of perjury entitles a defendant to a new trial. In the Kitchens case, the state secured Kitchens' conviction for arson largely through the testimony of George Herndon, who testified at trial that Kitchens and he set the fire at issue. Thereafter, in an affidavit offered in support of Kitchens' motion for a new trial, Herndon swore that his trial testimony was false and had been the result of beatings and continued threats administered by members of the sheriff's department. The statement was corroborated by an attorney, two other inmates, and a relative of Herndon. In reversing Kitchens' conviction, the Court of Appeals of Georgia concluded that conviction of a crime following a trial in which perjured testimony on a material point is knowingly used by the prosecution is an infringement on the accused's Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment rights to due process of law. Now let's turn back to Joey's case and see whether Mullinax's testimony meets the standard.
Here's District Attorney Tammy Colston previewing Mullinax's testimony in her opening statement. You need to be listening to him to judge this. Judge the credibility of another witness that is, quite frankly, I don't know what to tell you about him. His name is Barry Mullinax, and just because the state puts up a witness, we are not vouching for anybody's credibility. We are just putting up a witness for you to decide what you are going to decide. But the only way you're going to be able to decide about the credibility of some of these witnesses and whether they are telling the truth or not is looking for those little details they wouldn't know otherwise unless they were telling the truth. This is what I'm going to ask you to do, is to look at those. And then in her closing, she says, I put Barry Mullinax up there. I don't know how much you know about him, what you think about him. I don't know. He says he was there. He knows some things about where it occurred and the trajectory of the bullet and things like that. But you need to hear from him. I told you I'm not vouching for the credibility of any witness. I'm bringing to you what has been found in this investigation that has been relevant, admissible evidence in this investigation. What is relevant and admissible?
Colston asked the jury to look for those little details that they wouldn't know otherwise. Look for the little niggling things that are in there that show they're telling the truth. And she means it to say, well, Mullinax saw that Joey turned around at Paris Drive and went back to the scene. And her actual quote is, I will tell you what, that is very probable. And therefore, that validates what Barry Mullinax testified to. But I think there are other details in Mullinax's testimony that are worth paying attention to. Things like there was someone with long blonde hair in the car. And an odd detail like the car with the shooter only had one headlight. Now, I don't think Mullinax saw anything, and if he heard anything, it was probably from the cops themselves. But we know of someone with long blonde hair and a car with apparently one headlight that was driving that night. But it wasn't Joey. It was Heath Wilson. He had shoulder-length blonde hair, and one witness for the Highway 20 shooting recalls seeing only one headlight on his blue Honda. So why is Mullinax testifying, or telling the police, that he saw a car with one headlight and someone with long blonde hair that did the shooting of Isaac Dawkins?
What do you think's happening here? Do you think he's just getting things confused, like cases confused? Like, how is this, considering that the police themselves didn't take Heath Wilson seriously, how is this happening?
Not a clue. I mean, could he have gotten information from the police about the Highway 27 and 20 shootings and he muddles them up? Yeah. Could he have heard from someone else about this one headlight car and a long blonde hair driver? Maybe. We don't know. We don't have any clue because Mullinax is the most unreliable witness in the history of unreliable witnesses ever.
We do have Jay, but okay.
You know, I will take Jay over Mullinax because Jay approaches coherency once in a while. But I just found it fascinating that Tammy Colston tells the jury, just look for those details. That'll tell you the truth of what he's saying. But those details are the ones that match up with other facts we know, seem to point a different direction. Anyway, apparently the question of whether or not to call Barry Mullinax to the stand was the source of some tension on the prosecution side. Although Sutton didn't testify at trial, according to Joey, he was present, actually sitting at the prosecution's bench beside Colston. And after Mullinax testified, Joey recalls seeing Sutton and Colston squabbling over something. It blows my mind that Tammy Colston called him as a witness. I don't understand how an attorney could do that.
Does it say what she said in the transcripts when she called him to the stand?
What do you recall?
Because in the transcripts, she says, for what good it's worth, I'm going to call Barry Mullinax to the stand. I'll never forget that.
How was her tone when she said that?
she picked up she had a folder in her hand, and she kind of waved it and, you know, kind of like took a sigh and was like, for what good it's worth, we call Barry Mullen next to the stand. And she looked back at Stanley Sutton, and they were actually arguing after she put him on a stand.
After he testified?
Yeah.
You could see Sutton and Tammy Coulson arguing?
Yeah, they were arguing during my trial.
I guess you couldn't hear what they're arguing about.
No, I couldn't hear what they were saying, but they were actually bickering at one another.
Yeah, and what's maddening about this is that the mere fact that Mullinax testified to seeing Joey commit the murder was sufficient for the Supreme Court of Georgia to cite that fact in its decision on Joey's appeals, because in assessing the evidence against Joey, they recite the facts and throw out casually, quote, an occupant in a blue or green passenger car fired a shot through the truck's back window and hit Dawkins in the head. One eyewitness identified Watkins the shooter. So they're using the fact that Mullinax testified as this sort of a straightforward fact supporting his guilt, when obviously there were serious questions about his credibility. And here's Joey himself talking about the usage of the testimony at trial.
Oh, what about Mullinax? You ran into him in prison, right?
Yeah. I ran into him. We stayed in the same place for a year, even though this guy took the stand and the Supreme Court of Georgia denied me because he said he seen me.
So here's my question, and I'm going to push back just a little bit on this, is that, you know, you frame it as the mere fact that Mullinax, well, why is that a mere fact? I would think that's kind of an important fact. I mean, it led to a conviction. So wouldn't a Supreme Court rely on these kind of findings of fact from the trial record anyways? I mean, like, it doesn't seem unusual to me that they would cite to something like this. I think I've seen this in Adnan's case as well, where you have, like, you know, I mean, like, they pull from the record, and this is part of the record that led to a conviction.
Yeah, it's the sufficiency of evidence standard. Doesn't matter how good the evidence was. As long as it's there, as long as it exists, it's sufficient.
So doing what Coulson did isn't harmless. Deliberately calling an eyewitness that you know is lying so that he can identify the defendant as the shooter, I don't care how many, for whatever it's worth, you preface testimony with, that's horrifying. And besides, Coulson fought back very hard to try and rehabilitate Mullinax, to make his testimony seem more credible, by, for instance, using Detective Mosier to attempt to explain away some of the inconsistencies that they found. For instance, when she was questioning Mosier about how he investigated Mullinax's testimony, she asked him about the whole job application thing. Mosier says, yeah, we checked out the jobs he applied for, but it didn't work out. They didn't say he applied there. And Coulson asked Mosier, did you talk to any temporary placement services? And Mosier says, no, ma'am, I don't recall. As if to suggest to the jury, he applied for different jobs that Mosier never checked out. Now, this last one is one of Colston's favorite moves. I call it playing the throw Mosier under the bus card. Because it's not Colston's witnesses that are the problem. It's this idiot investigator Mosier who keeps asking her witnesses the wrong questions, which causes these problems. Because, gee, poor Barry Mullinax. He had applied for a job, probably, just like he said. But Mosier never checked with any temp agencies, so he didn't figure it out.
So I want to tell you a quick story. Back when we first learned that Mack Weldon was a sponsor, the Undisclosed team had a really funny email exchange talking about how we were going to support Mack Weldon. I'd been wearing Mack Weldon for a while and I knew what a great product it was, but the UD3 were not so familiar with it, but Susan had some great ideas for how to sell it. So I'm going to pull a line from an email that she sent me describing her perfect pitch for Mack Weldon. Here we go. As lawyers, we know what good briefs take, and at Undisclosed, we especially know how important things kept from the public eye can be. So when it comes to Undisclosed briefs, that's why we recommend Mack Weldon. Boom! Susan nailed it, and I am using her line here to show support for a great sponsor, and that's Mack Weldon. Look, I don't wear Mack Weldon because the team likes to have fun talking about underwear. I wear Mack Weldon because their product feels wonderful. There's no better men's underwear, men's socks, men's shirts on the market right now, not for casual wear, not for gym wear, not for anywhere. I guarantee you that Mack Weldon is better than anything you're wearing right now. So try Mack Weldon. Get yourself some. It's easy to do. All you have to do is go to www.mackweldon.com and use the promo code UNDISCLOSED. Buy yourself some comfortable threads. You're going to be glad you did. Again, that site is www.macweldon.com, and the promo code is undisclosed.
So if you're like me, you're probably wondering a lot about this other apparent passenger who was with Barry Mullinex. He says it at trial. He says it in the statements that he wasn't alone in his car. He was with his alleged girlfriend at the time, Tina Prue. But Prue never came to trial. So the question is, can Prue corroborate what he had to say?
We tried reaching out to Tina on Facebook, but never heard back. So one day when I was in Rome already, I decided to swing by her house just to see. I was with a friend of mine from Atlanta, and she'd volunteered to go on a few trips with me. So the two of us showed up on her doorstep, and apparently Tina's first thought was that we were Jehovah's Witnesses. Then, when we introduced ourselves, she thought for a moment we were there on Barry's behalf, and almost turned us away. It wasn't until we explained that we were actually there investigating what Barry had claimed that she welcomed us in and agreed to an interview. She remembered Barry, sort of, but almost entirely because of this case and her being interviewed by the cops as a result of it. She'd certainly never been Barry's girlfriend. She'd met him back around the time when she'd moved to Rome, and they went on a couple dates, maybe, but that was it. It quickly became apparent that she didn't want to get involved with this Barry guy, and the next time she heard anything about him was when the two cops showed up on her doorstep, asking if she'd witnessed a murder with him. This is her explaining why she hadn't gotten back to us after we reached out to her on Facebook, and her response to Barry's claims at trial that she'd been too scared to admit to the police that she'd witnessed the shootings.
And that, too, it's not something that I dwelled on a lot. Like, even when I seen that on my face, I was like, dude, really? They're still believing this boy's lies? I'm not even going to mess with it because, honestly, I don't think I have anything to offer. That's the same thing I told the cops. So what can I offer if I wasn't there?
Mm-hmm. Well, it does help for the defense to know that you weren't there.
Yeah.
Because Barry did testify at trial, and the jury heard only his story that you were there with him. And that made him sound more credible. If they hear that his girlfriend, Tina Prue, was in the car with her kids, that makes him seem more of a reliable witness.
Dude, look, if I had my kids in a car and I seen somebody dead or get shot,
right,
first thing I would do would go to the police and get protection for my children. That'd be the first thing. I mean, no matter, foremost, my kids would come first, you know.
So you wouldn't have, if you'd seen someone shoot or kill someone, you would have called the cops?
Yeah.
Unsurprisingly, Tina told us that everything Barry said was untrue. She also told us, though, something we didn't expect, that the cops had told her something about Barry Mullinax's statements that don't show up in the files.
So what did the cops ask you when they came up to talk to you?
Just if he was driving my truck, which is he never drove my truck, period. Nobody ever drove my truck but me that I know of.
What kind of truck was it?
It was a green Dodge Ram quad pickup truck.
Is that an extended cab? So like,
yeah.
Okay, so you could have fit three kids in it, theoretically.
Well, yeah, you can, theoretically, but why would you take kids with you on a job interview?
Valid point.
Okay, that makes no sense to me, and I've never put an application in Cedar Town anywhere, so I would like to know where. I've never been there. I've never been to Cedar Town.
Were you aware that at trial, Barry testified that you were just too scared to get involved, and that's why you told the police that you hadn't been there?
No. I just knew that, like, when he said that, I didn't know. I can't even, like, really testify to that part because I can't remember if the cop told me he was trying to make a deal because he got in trouble.
What about a deal?
Like, I think Barry got arrested at Floyd County and he told detectives about the murder. I do believe that's the way it happened.
Did Barry ever mention a reward?
For who, him?
For coming forward about the murder.
Like I said, for some reason, before you not even mentioned that to me, I thought he was in jail and was getting offered something, but it could have been that he was looking for the award. I don't know. It was something along those lines of something.
But you're pretty sure it was something.
Yeah, it was something. I just can't remember. I mean, I'm pretty sure they wrote it down on their notes. It could have been that they were telling me the award, mm-hmm. and I just didn't understand what they were talking about. Maybe I just assumed.
So if Barry testified at trial that he didn't receive anything for coming forward, would that be contrary to what you heard from the cops?
It would be. Like, I knew he was getting something. I don't know if he was arrested and getting a deal, but they did mention something that he would be getting.
When we spoke to Tina, though, she'd had no idea that Barry Mullinax ended up testifying at a trial, or that the prosecution had claimed to a jury that she'd been too scared to come forward after witnessing a murder.
So I showed her the transcripts and let her see for herself what Barry had said in court.
Here is where he testified and called you his girlfriend, and that he didn't want to get you involved, but unfortunately he had to.
My thing is, where's the investigation's notes? If they asked me, and I told them no, and they found no...
Right. If it
where's that at?
They mentioned that you denied it. But then at trial they said it's because you were scared and didn't want to get involved.
But how can somebody speak for somebody in court if I wasn't there?
You weren't the only one.
That should be... Look, there's all kinds of... You cannot speak for somebody else.
That is usually how it works.
Do you know how bad I feel? This is terrible.
At Joey's trial, during Detective Mosher's cross, Mosher was asked about whether Tina had ever mentioned a deal, and Mosher denied it. The question was, Tina Proust said that Barry Mullinax was a big liar, and there was nothing to his story. She said he was trying to help himself on a deal, didn't she? Answer, I don't remember about the deal part, but the liar part, yes. But according to Tina, Detective Mosher, or whoever the detective was that was out there that day, is the one who told her in the first place that Barry's reason for coming forward was to seek a deal.
Now, this might all sound like shocking new information that was just uncovered recently for the first time, but that's actually not the case. And what we have is an excerpt here from Detective Moser's write-up on Tina Proust, and this was known to the prosecution before trial. Tina Proust can testify she was not with Barry Mullinex on Highway 27 South on January 11th, 2000. Ms. Proust can testify that Barry Mullinex has never driven her vehicle, that she knows nothing about the shooting on Highway 27 South, that Barry Mullinex is a liar, and she did not go with Barry Mullinex to Cedarton for him to file a job application with Harriet and Henderson. And so cycling back to what we discussed before in the Kitchens case and with Rule 3.3, if this was known to Tammy Colston at the time of trial, did she knowingly suborn perjury, and is that grounds for a new trial? Well, before I cited to the opinion of the Court of Appeals of Georgia in the Kitchens case, in which something similar happened, and ultimately the witness in that case recanted their allegations against the defendant after trial. And in this case, we have something very similar.
After Joey's trial, Mullinex did recant. Didn't take too long. A couple years later, Joey was in prison, and Mullinex was actually assigned to the same prison he was in. So, Joey and Mullinex got to talking.
Did he ever explain to you why he lied? I know he said a lot of reasons why, but did he ever tell you anything that seemed true?
He told me something about his kid. He's got a special needs kid, and he had a charge, had a pending charge, theft and assault charge or something. And Stanley Sutton told him that if he would say what he wanted him to say, that he would get those charges off of him, and he did.
So Mullinex told you he did get the charges off of him?
Yes, he got the charges off of him.
Thereafter, Mullinex wrote down two notes and sent them to Joey.
Here's what the note said. Joey, look, I'm sorry, dude. I told Rex and Bill O'Dell that Stanley Sutton forced me to lie on you. I got a life savings of about $20,000 that I will put toward getting you out. My life has been hell ever since that day in court, and sometimes I just want to kill myself for all the pain I cause you and your family. I ask for your forgiveness, and may God help us get you out and put Sutton where he belongs. Barry. The second note reads, also, they have got me locked down, but I don't care. Just have Rex, Bill come see me ASAP, because I feel that Stanley's going to try to do me in when I get out of prison. I'm suing Floyd County because this has made me go crazy, and Joey, I wish I could take your place because you don't deserve to be in prison. Barry.
So, when Barry Mullinax next gets out of prison, Joey Watkins' father picks him up. He drives him to a law office where they sit down for deposition. And Mullinax tells them everything he knows about why he testified to what he did at trial. Or, well, that's what they were hoping he'd say anyway.
Here's what Mullinax says. When I was forced to lie on Joey Watkins in court by Stanley Sutton, I've tried several times to commit suicide, and then when it put me in a mental illness state where I was diagnosed with post-traumatic syndrome. Question, post-traumatic stress disorder? Answer, yes, sir. They housed me there due to the fact that I was at the verge of killing myself because I was dealing with emotional stress due to the fact that I was forced and threatened that if I didn't lie on in Joseph Watkins' case, saying that I knew everything that went on, which I did not know anything about that case at the time until I was confronted by Stanley Sutton and asked me to lie. If I didn't lie, he said I would, one of my family members would deal with the consequences, me or one of my family members. So at the time, I didn't want nothing to happen to my daddy, who was disabled, or my mother, so I was forced into a situation to lie in court. Question. All right, now, who... He said this, Stanley Sutton. You're saying under oath that Stanley Sutton said this in the presence of Tammy Colston? Answer. No, Tammy Colston and them wasn't in there. He was in there with... We was in the room by ourselves, and then later on, he brung Tammy Colston and this other guy in, and when he was in there, he had me read this. Question. Read what? Answer, what he wanted me to say. Question, all right, now, tell us. Answer, I don't remember what I was supposed to say. Question, was it typed up? Answer, it was typed up telling me to say something about a car, the time that I seen Joey's arm come out the window and shoot this person, which, and I didn't ever see none of that. And I, far as I can remember, if, I could be wrong, but I do believe I was incarcerated at the time of this murder. I'm not for sure. It's so close to the time I got incarcerated, but I do believe I was incarcerated at the time of the murder.
Now, I want to clarify that everything Mullinax says about Sutton coercing him and threatening him to testify against Joey should be considered just as reliable as what he testified against Joey at his trial. Because nothing Mullinax ever says seems to make any sense, and he's happy to spin from one story to the next.
But again, I have to ask what the incentive would be, unless he is continually seeking attention, for him to write Joey those notes in prison. Or maybe he just became close to Joey and suddenly, I don't know. But again, to me, it's like, what is the incentive for him to then now come forward and say this stuff, especially about somebody who seems quite powerful like Sutton? These are kind of serious allegations to make.
I mean, if Colston thinks that Mullinax's testimony is valid against Joey, then yeah, this is valid against Stanley Sutton, and it's proof, quote unquote, that he threatened a witness and gave him a false statement to read. But I don't think either happened.
You don't think Sutton did that?
Here's the thing. When Barry Mullinax first came forward, it was to Mosier, not to Sutton. Now, he talked to Sutton later. We don't know about what. There's no notes or recording of what actually went on. But as far as we know, Sutton wasn't involved when this story first came to light. Or at least the person Mullinax was talking to was the Rome officer, not the Floyd County one.
For me, it comes down to Mullinax is just completely unreliable. I don't know whether he's making up the story about Sutton. He might be, he might not be, but it seems pretty clear overall he has no clue whatsoever about this Isaac Dawkins shooting. He wasn't there. That's clear from Benson's statement. It's clear from Tina Prue's statement. It's clear from the fact that he didn't apply for the jobs he claimed he applied for. So again, I can't say necessarily whether Sutton had a role or has significant a role, but regardless, it's clear Mullinax, not a witness to this shooting, has nothing to tell us about this crime.
Regardless of the fact that Barry Mullinax recanted his testimony, it wouldn't make a whit of difference for Joey Watkins. The truth is, there was no eyewitness ever who could identify the shooter. But for Joey, the damage was done, permanently, and it remains that way even until today. Mullinax is a prime example of how dangerous and unreliable jailhouse snitches can be. And thanks to the continued efforts of Stanley Sutton in this case, Mullinax was only one of dozens. Yeah, I said dozens, of jailhouse snitches that came forward to not only implicate Joey, but to help Sutton nail down the person that the state would eventually charge with being Joey's accomplice, Mark Free. Next time on Undisclosed.
Claire Gilbert of the Georgia Innocence Project, here to help me read the credits. I'm excited. Claire, it sounds like you've been getting some love from Undisclosed fans down at GIP. Can you tell me about that?
We have been getting some love. We have a new website and new fundraising platform, and people have been using it and noting in the comments section that they're Undisclosed fans and that they're donating to us because of that and to keep up the good work on Joey's case. And we are really, really appreciate it.
That is so cool. Undisclosed fans, thank you for stepping up. I want to note, you know, Joey's case is obviously important to you all because you're listeners, but Joey's case is just one of the many cases that the Georgia Innocence Project handles. They are overwhelmed, and they could use all the help that you could send them. So please, please, please donate to the Georgia Innocence Project so they can keep doing great work for cases just like Joey's and the dozens of others they have to handle. So go donate. And also, hey, thanks, Claire. You should come back and help me read the credits next week. But for this week, here they are. Let's go. Sponsors up. First, we've got Stamps.com. Great sponsor. Thanks for coming back. Blue Apron, our most delicious sponsor. We appreciate you very much. And as always, Mack Weldon. The comfort you give me every day is greatly appreciated. Thank you. Podster Magazine did a really cool write-up of Undisclosed in its most recent issue. The Evidence Professor contributed to that article, so make sure you go check it out. You can find the article at www.shelfmediagroup.com. Let's talk about our producers, Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the great podcast Crime Writers On makes this thing sound wonderful. She gets help from Hannah McCarthy and Brooke Giddings of the Actual Innocence podcast. Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez composed our theme music. It sounds wonderful. The infamous Baluki did our logo. Our website was created by Nina Musser, and she gets help from Christy Williams. There are some very cool people maps there designed by Heidi Phelps. Also, episode transcripts for those who would rather not hear our voices but would read our words. Behind the scenes, we have producer Methil Telham putting it all together. One of the coolest parts of her job is helping out with social media, particularly the Instagram. You can get at us on the social medias by finding at Undisclosed Pod. We're on the Twitter. We're on the Facebook. We're on the YouTubes too, which is pretty cool. Got some videos there you should definitely check out. Talk to us using our handle, but also drive the conversation on the social media using hashtag Undisclosed. Or, in the alternative, you can send a question to Mr. John Cryer, host of the fabulous Undisclosed Addendum, by tweeting at him with the hashtag UDAddendum. Ask him a question and maybe he'll read it on air. The executive producer for this magical journey of a podcast we call Undisclosed is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to seeing you next week for episode 9. Until then.
Okay, I need to know if this is like they literally mean actual grasshoppers.
He had been in the gully catching grasshoppers and putting them in his mouth so he could walk up there and open his mouth and they come flying out.
Okay, was it to be funny? Was it like a joke? Was he eating them? I can't make the connection. I don't understand what's happening here. I don't understand the story.
It's a joke. I mean, it's kind of funny. I would have laughed.